AA meeting that I ever chaired and how I felt. And I remember being nervous. I remember feeling flushed and opportunity to stand in front of you. Now, the chair at every meeting that we do has to introduce the speaker. Okay. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bob. I told you I was nervous and sweating. And I still think I'm honored, but anyway. You know, when we chair a meeting, we always have the discussion leader, somebody we have to introduce. And it's pretty easy to do at regular meetings because we generally know the person that we're going to introduce, or at least we've been in meetings with them and we can say something nice because we know them. However, at a roundup like this, it's a little different because the speakers come from all over the country. And one of the responsibilities of the chair is to meet the speaker and get to know them a little bit. And one of the ways we do that is we generally pick them up at the airport. However, Ralph lives in California and I was in California, so I didn't pick Ralph up at the airport. Another way we do this is we meet them and we take them out to lunch and we sit and we talk and we learn a little bit about them so that we can introduce them and tell a nice story. But Ralph had a sponsoree here that he was going to hook up with from California, so I didn't take him out to lunch. So today at dinner, we said, well, I'll sit with him at dinner, and we'll talk, and I'll get to know him a little bit at dinner so I can introduce him. I didn't sit with him at dinner. But the other thing we can do is we can listen to their tape. And I did that. And the tape I heard was a great message and a great talk. And I told Ralph earlier when they made the announcement that because of the setup here, as soon as Ralph is finished, he's going to be escorted out, and then we can greet him and talk to him at the hospitality area so that they can get the room ready. And I said, well, Ralph, you know, they're gonna hustle you out of here because you're a celebrity. And he said to me, well, I hope they don't hustle me out before I'm finished. But we're honored to have Ralph. And with that, I give you Ralph W.
My name is Ralph White, and I am an alcoholic. First off, I want to thank my wonderful friend, Bob, for an excellent introduction. I want to thank Doug, I want to thank Dick Anderson, the first person who called me on behalf of the Atlanta Roundup. I met Dick in Amarillo, Texas last year. And shortly after I got home, I got a call from Dick, which was soon followed up by a call from Doug. And I want to thank Doug for his hospitality, too. Then I spoke with OK. And since I've been here and subsequent to getting here, I really want to thank you for your example and for putting on a hell of a party. And after that, I was picked up at the airport by a new friend, Tony. And Tony picked my wife and I up, and Tony brought us to the hotel, and Tony hung out with us yesterday. And I want to thank you. And following that, I've had the opportunity to fellowship with a number of members of this fellowship here, and I want to thank you for the Southern hospitality. You know, I've met a lot of new friends, and I'm looking forward to meeting more friends, and you treated my wife and I with, like I said, the kind of Southern hospitality we were expecting when we came out here. So again, I'm grateful and I'm honored. I was speaking to a couple of people. At dinner, I did get a chance to sit with some people. Gwen, who informed me she loves hearing her name from the podium, so wherever you are. And I met with some men today, and we kind of had an impromptu men's meeting, Jim and Matt and John over here and some of the other men who were members. And I was speaking to people, and I was struck by the recovery that's in this room. And I was like, damn, does anybody in here that I'm going to encounter have less than 20 years of recovery? You know. And I'm humble. I am humble. You know that I'm the speaker tonight in front of you and in front of this group of men and women who have been demonstrating the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I want to do something that might be a little bit out of order, but just so I can get put at ease a little bit, do we have any new friends here in their first 1 to 29 days of recovery? If so, we do. Any new friends? On behalf of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to sincerely welcome you home. And if you be the kind of alcoholic that I am, I want to let you know this is probably the best step you can take from the cradle to the grave. And I don't say that because I'm the nice speaker. I don't say that because I'm at a podium at a roundup. I don't say that it's because it's what we say when we get behind podiums in Alcoholics Anonymous. I say it because that's been my experience. And since I've entered the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, man, this program, this fellowship, and this power that you introduced me to has been working in my life, and I've been getting results like I've never gotten before. And that's why I talk so much about this program. That's why I talk so much about this process. That's why I talk so much about this power that I've been introduced to. And coming in a group like this with the kind of recovery that's in these rooms, I just told you, people with 20, 30, even 40 some odd years of recovery, you know, my first temptation is to say, I'm not going to share a long drunkologue. I just want to share about recovery. But to our new friends, you may be somewhat like I was when I first came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember sitting in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, my first or second meeting, and a speaker was standing up in front of the group, somewhat like I'm standing up in front of the group tonight. He was dressed pretty well, and his hair was combed, and his eyes were bright. He was stringing sentences together real well, and I remember thinking to myself that night, I know this cat has not been where I've been. I know he has not felt what I felt. I know he has not done what I've done. What can this lame tell me? So it is very important that I let you know that the man that's standing in front of you tonight is not the same one that stumbled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous October 11th, 1986. I'm going to share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today in the hopes that somebody sitting in the room might be thinking to themselves, damn, I used to do that. Man, I used to feel like that. Or like the book says, most importantly, I too want to have this thing. It is impossible for you to appreciate the man that's standing in front of you tonight if you don't know where it is that I come from. You know, I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. Some of you may have heard of my community. It was in the news. You know, I talked to some people around here, so I know of some people that go back to my era and beyond. My community where I grew up was in the news back in the early 60s. I'm from the heart of Watts.
I grew up in a little two-bedroom apartment, and we didn't have a whole lot. I didn't really notice it at the time. I have five brothers, so it was six boys in my family, and we stayed in that little two-bedroom apartment. Moms and pops stayed in one room. The six boys stayed in three bunk beds in the other room. My earliest memory of my old man was he was an alcoholic, and I didn't want to be like him. He was not abusive, and he was not violent. My father was an absentee drunk, and every other Friday, like clockwork, you could count on him not showing up at the house. And it would be a little kid in the neighborhood who felt it was his duty to come around and inform my family how my old man had been showing his behind the previous Friday or Saturday night up at the pool hall. And I would feel ashamed, and I would feel embarrassed, and those are feelings I'm familiar with from a real early age. I can remember some Saturday mornings my mom would be in their room, and she'd have this broom going up under the bed, and I could hear those ripple bottles clinking together as she swept them out from under the bed and put them in a big brown bag and took them outside to put in the big trash can. And I remember how I felt like I never want to be like him. He was weak. He didn't provide to us. He made me ashamed. He wasn't somebody I was proud of. And my earliest vow about my old man was, I will not be like him. I'm not going to be like my daddy. He got put out the house when I was 8 or 9 years old. Me and my brothers thought he looked good going. And my mom proceeded to raise these six boys by herself. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, ideal family life when I was growing up, what I thought an ideal family would be, came from television. That gave me my pictures of what ideal families were supposed to be. And in the era when I grew up, the ideal families that were on TV, Ozzie and Harriet, Father Knows Best, My Three Sons, Donna Reed, trust me, that was not jumping off in my house. You know, when you're grown, you get something that's called perspective, and perspective works like this. You have a mom that raised six boys by herself. She didn't have a high school education, you know, and she was on welfare at the time. You had this mom that was determined to get off welfare. So my mom put herself back through high school. She put herself through college. She worked two jobs. She took in clothes that she washed and ironed for other folk. And when you're grown, you look back on your life and say, damn, I had a hell of a mom. Look how she sacrificed to raise her boy. But when you're a kid about 9 or 10 years old and you can't bring a couple of partners home on a Wednesday afternoon and you hit the front door and mom's is in the living room with a rag on her head and the ironing board up, you don't feel proud. You feel ashamed and embarrassed, and you stop bringing partners home from school. And if your name is Ralph, you retreat into that fantasy world I've lived in a lot of my life about what life is really like for me at the house. And if you're me, you start living in that prison I've lived in much of my life. It's the biggest prison I've ever lived in. It's the prison I live in sometimes today. And that's the prison of what I think you think about me. See, I don't know what you think about me, but I'm trapped in what I think you think about me. And I'll do whatever it takes to shape and form and mold your opinion around. I'll wine you, I'll dine you, I'll woo you, I'll con you, I'll bully you, I'll manipulate you, I'll buy you. Please like me. Now, I don't particularly have to like your ass, but please like me. Right about here in the proceedings, I think it's important that we take a little break, because somebody's getting twisted what we got going on right now. Somebody is out there thinking to themselves, this guy might be all right speaking. He's looking around the room, making eye contact with everybody. Don't let that fool you. I'm looking for the person whose attention is drifting, look like you're going to sleep. I'm going to work on your ass. You will like me before this is over. Trapped in what I think you think about me. And to our new friends, you'll hear a lot of things shared from podiums at Alcoholics Anonymous. And we say listen for the similarities. One of the common themes in Alcoholics Anonymous from a lot of our members is I never felt like I fit in. And that's not a part of my story. I'm a little guy. I like a lot of attention. I've never been interested in fitting in. I've always wanted to stand out. And as a result of that... as a result of that, I did and I accomplished a lot of things. Every one of you had me in your school, and this is my story, you know, and it's not from any virtue on my part, a lot of it. A lot of it was fear-driven. I was scared of my mama. My daddy was, was alcoholic, but my mother, my mom, was an old Southern Baptist sister that did not play, and she raised her boys with an iron fist, man, and moms didn't play. So a lot of what I share with you guys that I did come, it wasn't because of virtue, it was fear. But I'm the kid that was always, all of you had me in your school. I was a straight-A student in school. I was always class president or student body president. I played ball. I made all-stars. On the outside, I had a lot of things going on that seemed like I should have been okay. In the inside, I've always felt like if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. Because at the schools I went to and in the neighborhoods I grew up in, it was not a real badge of honor to be a straight-A student. You know what I mean? Because, yeah, I was a straight-A student, yeah, I was class president, yeah, I was teacher's pet, but I would have traded it all in, man, if I would have been cool. If I just could have been cool, man. The cats who were cool were shooting dice in the bathroom, smoking cigarettes, taking quarters, and they knew how to talk to girls. And that was a mystery, man, beyond me. I was a shy kid growing up, and anyway, we're going to fast forward with this story. You know, I'm shy. I listened to Mary Emma last night, and I really, really, really want to thank her for getting this party started right. You know, thank you. You know, it's a hard act to follow, you know, and she really gave it up. We're from the same era. We came out of school the same year, so I identify with much of what she said. In my story is I'm a late bloomer. You know, I'm one of the ones that I didn't do anything for a long time. You know, and we're going to fast forward. I'm in high school now, and I'm still not doing anything, and I'm still scared of girls. But I have a girlfriend, first girlfriend at 16 years old. Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 does not mean the same thing it meant for a lot of you guys with girlfriends at 16. Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 means this. I ran with a crew of dudes who went with the same crew of girls. They kind of rotated them around, right? And one of my boys broke up with this girl. I waited a suitable amount of time to pass, and then I said, I want to go with her. And I told my other boy, I want to go with her. He went and asked her. He came back and told me, you know. He came back and told me, she said yes. Now I have a girlfriend. I didn't know what to do with her. I'm 16 years old. You know, I would carry books home from school occasionally and the rest of that. And I suffer some of those pre-senior moments sometimes. So bring me back. I would carry her books home from school. I was shy because I'm going to go down a path and I don't want to get stuck. But don't you miss the days when boys just carried the girls' books home from school? Some of y'all might be fathers and have daughters now. And trust me, it would be a nice thing if it was just a nice young man carrying. Bring me back. I don't want to go there. Anyway. That's what I used to do. I would carry my girls' books home from school every now and then. And we might go to the show and I might kiss, you know. And this is me. This is me. This is mid-60s, right? I'm 16 years old. This is my girlfriend. If you ask her, she would say, yes, I go with Ralph. This is official, on the record, not ashamed of me claiming me, right? And what I would do, I would call her on the phone, on those old rotary phones, and the seventh number would come around and it would go back. And when that seventh number was going back, terror would set in. Right? Because I knew what would have to happen when she answered the phone. You got to talk. It's the telephone, right? And I didn't have no conversation. So anyway, this is a snapshot of me. This particular night, I'm going out on a date with my girl. Me and my girl were in the back seat of an older partner of mine's car. Him and his girl were in the front seat. We were on a double date going to the drive-in. And this particular night, a plastic cup of rum and coke came to the back seat. And I drank that rum and coke down, man, and it went down real warm. Seemed like it rushed back to the top of my brain. And all of a sudden, Ralph's hands started doing things they had never done. And, you know. mouth started saying things it had never said, and I had arrived. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. It gave me the courage to do and to be and to say things I wouldn't do, be, and say without it. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about me in a lot of places. And it starts talking about me, curiously enough, in the front of the book. In the doctor's opinion, there's a line in there that goes something like this. Men and women like Ralph drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol, and I recognized it the first time I saw it. Recognized it immediately. Later on in life, when you call me at happy hours and I'd be putting down a couple too many people, Ralph, why you drink? Oh, I like the taste of Long Island Iced Tea. If I was drinking for taste, I could have stuck with Minute Maid Fruit Punch. I like the taste of that. You know, I like what alcohol did for me, you know. Unlike Mary Emma, I was not overnight alcoholic, though. That first night I drank a couple that night, and I got a warm, fuzzy feeling, and I liked what it did. And my drinking stayed that way for a while. I understand when we talk about this disease being progressive in nature, because that's how it showed itself in my experience. I started drinking, and my drinking stayed that way throughout high school, throughout the mid and late 60s. I just drank when I would go to parties. You know, drinking what youngsters drink at that time where I came up. Tyrolia, Boone's Farm, Annie Green, you know what youngsters be drinking. You know, and I graduated from high school in 1971, and I started college, and I graduated to higher education in every sense of the word. In 1971, my drinking was still just to go to parties. By the end of 1971, I was drinking not only to go to parties, but now to creep up to during the day on the weekend to get ready for the parties. By 1972, I'm drinking not only on weekends, but now I'm drinking after class. By the end of 1972, I'm drinking and I've added non-addictive marijuana to it, and I'm doing this on a... And I'm doing this now every single day. By 1973, I'm drinking, I'm using, I'm doing it on a daily basis, and you couldn't have told me it was anything wrong with the way that I was living. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about at a certain point in my drinking career, I won't be able to tell the truth from the false. And the way that that showed up in my experience was this. The way that I'm getting loaded, isn't that the way everybody gets loaded? Trust me, if you were coming up in the late 60s, early 70s, it seemed like that's the way everybody was getting loaded. Why would you be young with a bright future, with a little bit of money? I was giving financial aid. Then chase a woman. You know, didn't chase some women and get loaded, come with the territory. Man, in those days, if you came over my house and I couldn't offer you something to drink or something to smoke, I wasn't being a good host. And if I went over your house and you didn't do the same for me, not only weren't you being a good host, I wasn't coming over your house no more. For what? Wasn't nothing to discuss. You know what? I am so glad that I came up at the time that I came up. No offense to any of our young friends here. We are glad that you are here and you can get out the hole as fast as soon as you are ready to stop digging. So we welcome, but I am glad I came up when I came up. Because in 2003, man, life just seemed crazy. They got sexually transmitted, safe sex, AIDS, all this old kind of, man, in those days, didn't life just seem real simple? Back then, I would go to a club and I would have a one-question interview for a girl. You get high? If not, next. Don't need your name, social, your sign, and where do you work? None of that. Let's get to what the threshold of what's going to be the foundation of this relationship. You know. And that's how I thought, man. And in those days, that's just how it was. You would go to a concert, you wouldn't even have to know your neighbors. We just passing. So, you know, that's how we rolled back then, man. And I came out of school some kind of way in 1976, and I started working as a counselor for L.A. City Schools. You know, and... Even though I had the kind of job that should have allowed me to start acquiring and accumulating things the normal people did, I never did that. I never did that. Snapshot of Ralph's life. This is when alcohol was working. This is when it was working. I used to buy a car, and I did this three times. I would buy a car. I would make exactly three car payments. Then come find it. Come find it. They would. I'd get another. Come find it, you know. I'm the kind of brother that never had a problem balancing a bank book. Payday, I got money. 2 days later, broke. Zero. No problem balancing my bank book. I stayed in the crib from 1976 to 1979 without paying rent. And this is when it was working. A couple of baffling features about the disease I suffer from, and one of them is this. I can't see my relationship with alcohol until I'm free of it. I can't see what it's doing to me when I'm in the mix. So some of what I'm sharing right now that is very clear to me in the rearview mirror of experience was not at all clear to me when I was going through it. One fact stands out real clear about those days when alcohol was working. I used to go to work for 2 weeks to live for 2 days. That's it, that's all. I worked a party, period. You know, can't tell you the hour, can't tell you the moment, can't tell you the day, can't tell you the time, can't tell you where I was or what I was doing. When alcohol ceased to be a luxury and it became a necessity. I like the way Bill describes the invisible line. All I can tell you is that day came for me. And I can remember when I was out there in the life, I used to see partners of mine. I see somebody like Matt. I get like his at. I'm quitting. You know, I see somebody else. You know, I always look around me. You need to quit. Ooh-wee. You need to get some help. You know, it reminds me of the story I tell sometime about a little boy named Johnny. And Johnny had a problem his father frowned on. Johnny used to like to play with himself. And his father goes off to work this particular day, and he comes home early. Little Johnny's bedroom door is closed, so his father opens the door without knocking. Sure enough, little Johnny's in the bedroom masturbating. His father looks at him and says, "Son, I thought I told you if you keep doing that, you'll go blind." And little Johnny stopped and looked at his dad and said, "Well, Daddy, can I just do it till I need glasses?" You know. And with some of the people I associated with, that kind of reminds me of me in the life. Yeah, I'm going to do it just till I, yeah, right. You know. And the book talks about seeking the Lord companion, and it wasn't long before I became the Lord companion. And we don't have enough time for me to tell you all the things that I went through. There should have been signs along the way. But there are some stories that just stand. I got married in 1980, Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I had a bachelor party the night before my wedding day. None of the rest of these guys are going to be the groom the next day, but all of them have sense enough to go home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Me, groom, I'm still at the bachelor party till 7:30 that next morning. Me and my brothers, right? Four of us ended up in the program. You know, then they take me home at 7:30. They pour me in the bed. They get me up at 11 o'clock to get ready for my 1 o'clock wedding. I'm tore up. I am tore. You know why I still love going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous 16 and a half years later? Because I can just come in a room and just drop that sentence out there, and I really don't have to embellish it no further. A lot of people, yeah, I know, been there. Yeah, you know. I'm tore up, right? I've been up all night. You know? And so I just laid on the bed. I didn't go, I'm tore. And so they get me up to go to my wedding, and I get there. I'm supposed to say my own vows. And the way I wobbled up in there, my then wife-to-be took one look at me wobbling in there. She looked at the preacher. She looked back at me. She looked at the preacher and said, "Scratch the own vow. Say the regular on his ass," right? So now my lines are cut to two words, so I'm standing at the altar. So I'm standing there, and it gets to me. I get ready to say, "I do." I say, and threw up all over. passed out. Have not taken a wedding picture to this day. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Again, let me talk to our new friends for a minute. If you're anything like me, when you first hit the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you hear a lot of things shared. I recognize the words, but I just didn't recognize the way the people in here used those words, because they weren't the way I used them in my everyday walk-around vocabulary. They were in here talking about a psychic change, and the phenomenon of craving, and this allergy of the body. And I needed some of the old-timers around here to help me with some of that. But the first time I heard pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, didn't need no help with that one. Folk like us don't need a dictionary for pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I lived pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization up close and personal, and I lived it over and over and over and over and over and over again. Because I need to let you know that that wedding day was the high point of that marriage. Went downhill after that. Because I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband can remember sitting on the living room couch, wife coming out the bathroom real fast, pulling her pants up, going to the dining room table and picking the purse up off the table and clutching it real close to her as she took it back to the bathroom. And I would feel this tall because nobody was in my house but me and her, but it got like that in my house. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember coming home one night, sticking the key in the door, open the door, and wife and two-year-old daughter sitting right here, and they're both crying. I look over here, and homeboy is sitting in my chair with a gun pointed at my stomach saying, I want my money right now. Let me talk to the man for just a moment. I don't know about if any of the rest of you fellas have the same doubts and fears that I had when I was out there about, do I have what it takes to be a father? Do I have what it takes to be a husband? Because if you're in the life, your track record already gives you your answer, right? Because what's the father's role and what's the husband's role? To protect and to provide. And it's a cold-blooded feeling, fellas, laying in bed with a woman night after night after night after night, knowing not only aren't you protecting, knowing not only aren't you providing, you're the one bringing the wolf to the door. Because my house got broke into 4 times. I pretended to call the local police department. And each time I was going through those motions, playing that game, I knew what had happened because they told me, you're going to give us our money or we coming up in there and getting it. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband can remember sitting on my back porch, two-year-old daughter coming outside pulling in my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. And I remember stopping and giving her a little shitty grin. Don't worry, baby. Daddy's going to put some dollar bills in here for this change. And I wasn't raised to be stealing from my daughter, and I wasn't raised to be stealing from my wife. But I was an alcoholic with no tools of recovery, and I did what it took to get what I needed to get. I share with you guys that my disease is progressive in nature, and in my experience, it's progressive in a couple of areas. I share one area already. It takes more than it used to take for me to get the same effect. But my disease is progressive in another area, my behavior. My behavior gets progressively worse. I'm willing to do more readily than I used to be willing to do in order to pursue this thing. First time I hit my wife's purse, I thought long and hard about it, and guess what? I was not stealing. No way, because I don't do that. I don't steal, period, and you really don't steal from your family. And I took that $40 out of her purse, and I said with everything in me, a minute, I'm going to replace this money before she knows it's missing. And I meant it. And I went out and spent that $40. Pay that. 2 weeks later, same scenario presented itself.
And I went out and I had been on one of these runs and I had spent all my money and come home looking for her purse. And she wasn't in the habit of hiding the purse yet. And that vow about replacing the money, you know, Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous says for reasons we don't know about, the alcoholic will be unable to recall with sufficient force pain, suffering, and humiliation of weeks, even days ago. Didn't even come to mind. Did not come to mind. And I didn't deliberate so long before I hit the purse this next time. And from that moment on, I was hitting my wife's purse on a regular basis. She started sleeping with it up under the pillow. Something about laying in bed with that feeling on me where I got to have some money and knowing the money is just an arm's length away. And I'd be laying in that bed and she'd be sleeping with the purse up under the pillow. And I'd lay there and I'd wait and I'd let that real regular breathing set in. And I let it set in for a little while, right? And then I come out my side of the bed and I crawl around to her side and I come up under that pillow and I come up real slow, put the purse in front of me, creep out the bedroom, creep out the living room door, jump in the Volkswagen, coast out the driveway, I'm gone. It's Monday. I come back Wednesday. I did that one too many one Mondays, came back one Wednesday. There's a note on my door. The rest of your stuff is at your mama's house. There's a suitcase on the porch. I'm put out of my house. I am now my daddy. And I go to stay at my mom's house. And slowly but surely, this is in the early 80s, I have five brothers. Each one of them had either a family or was staying on their own. Somewhere in about 1981 or 82, all five of my brothers ended up with me back in my mom's house. So my mom had these six practicing alcoholics under her roof. She used to come home every single day with a grocery bag with her food for the day. Because if she kept food in the refrigerator, these six grown leeches that she gave birth to, there would be nothing there for her. She suffered a nervous breakdown. She put us out of the house and she changed the locks. There were bars on the window and she did not know we had rigged the window that you use for the fires. We rigged that window and the highlight of my day was waiting for my mom to go to work at 6:30 so one of us could crawl in her window and let the rest of us in the house. I need to back up a minute. When my ex-wife put me out and I went to stay at my mom's house, she thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man that she married. And she used to bring my daughter over to my mom's house on Saturday afternoons so we could keep a father-daughter relationship. And I wanted to be a father to my little girl with everything in me. I really, really, really did. I wanted to take my girl to Disneyland and Magic Mountain. I wanted to walk up the street with her on a Saturday with her little hand and my big hand and just take her to the store to get ice cream. I wanted to sit her in my lap and read stories to her. I wanted to tuck her in bed at night and give her a good night kiss. I wanted to get a look for my little girl that I've seen men in this fellowship get since I've been here. The look like this is my daddy and this is my hero. And the best I could do on those Saturday afternoons was 30 minutes. 30 minutes. I tell my mom something like I'm going to the store to get Rain some ice cream, and I would disappear. It would be Saturday afternoon. I would come back on Monday morning. I'd sneak back on Sunday night when her mom was picking her up. And I could remember, man, on those long Sunday nights, I'd be sticking my head around the side of my mom's house, peeking at them. And I'd see both those heads in that car, and as those headlights were backing out the driveway, I'd be crying, thinking to myself, there go my life backing out this driveway. I've heard a lot of people share about being scared of dying when they were out there. That ain't my story. I was never scared of dying. I was scared I was going to keep waking up to the same old thing. Monday the same as Tuesday, the same as Christmas, over and over and over again. And I am so glad God don't make misery comfortable. And I got miserable enough. And I got tired enough that on October the 11th in 1986, I got directed to my fourth program of recovery. And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on October the 13th. And I was tore up, man. I was so full of fear and I was so full of regret and I was so full of remorse when I was in there. and a guy was standing in front of the room sharing with the group. And I remember, man, because I was sitting in that room, like I said, full of remorse, full of guilt, full of shame, full of I'll never be able to forgive myself for the things I'd done. I only share with you guys the tip of the iceberg. I didn't share with you when I got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house and started stealing out my mom's purse. Didn't share with you when I got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house. A check came to one of my little brothers in the name of R. White. All of us are R. White. Stole it. Didn't share with you when my grandmother gave me $200 to buy her plane ticket to the family reunion right here in Atlanta. My grandmother never would have saw Atlanta, Georgia if it was not for my mom. Didn't share with you the first time I tried to get sober, my ex-wife got me a job at a radio station, stole $1,600 from them, ruined her reputation in that industry. Suffice it to say, I had a lot on my tip when I came in here, and I never thought I'd be able to forgive myself for the things I had done. And a speaker was standing in front of the group like I'm standing in front of the group tonight, and he was sharing about taking from the job, and he was sharing about taking from the family. And I remember looking at him and thinking to myself, damn, you look scandalous. You should have been doing scandalous. I'm different. Y'all ain't gonna hear my business. And the speaker seemed like he knew I was in the room and read my mail, because he dropped something on me like this. He said, if you're sitting in this room tonight, you are not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. And you have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. And you don't have to drink and you don't have to use no matter what, provided you are willing to fulfill some conditions. And he caught my attention. And he went on to say, this is the only club you can be a member of where the worse off you are when you get here, the better off your chances of staying. And I got the message of hope. And I got the message of hope at that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I went to. He described to me what I suffer from. And for the first time, nobody was talking at me. He was talking about himself. For a long time, people have been telling me, with that kind of girl you got, ooh, you should quit doing that. Look at what you're doing to that baby. Look at what you're doing to that girl. Look at what you're doing to yourself. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and this guy was standing up in front of the podium, and he was talking about himself, and he was hitting me where I live. And he shared with me what I suffer from, that it's something bodily different about me than other folk. I had suspected that, but I had it backwards. I thought that the reason that I drank so much was because, yes, something bodily different about me. I got high capacity. The rest of you are poopers. You can't. If you could, you roll like this too. No, 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 smart guy. You sit down, shut up, and listen. You know, and he described to me there's something bodily different about me, and he invited me to diagnose myself. Ralph, don't take my word for it. Look at your own experience. How many times did you say, oh, I'm just going to spend $20? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm just going to happy hour? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm just going to stop off over my boys for a couple? What happened? Don't look at the times you set out to get tore up. Look at the times you said, I'm just going to stop off for a minute. What happened? Did it happen once? Did it happen twice? If your name is Ralph, every 2 weeks, whole paycheck, over and over and over and over and over. My experience shows me when I take one of anything, no matter where I have to go, what I have to do, who I have to see, no matter how great the wish or the necessity, my body takes over and I have to have another. Okay, Ralph, smart guy, if it's just my body, how do you explain stone sober? My car seemed to drive to the LIQ on payday. Second part of this disease, the mental obsession, the obsession that somehow, someday, I'll be able to control and enjoy this magic potion I discovered oh so many years ago. And that's a cold obsession to have, because that's a hell of a delusion, to control and enjoy. Kind of guy I am. Kind of guy I am. If I'm controlling, I ain't enjoying, and if I'm enjoying, I damn sure ain't controlling. You know, that's a lie in and of itself. I can't drink because of my body. I can't stop because my mind refuses to accept that fact. I'm powerless. Third part of this disease, spiritual malady. 12 and 12 sometimes calls it a soul sickness. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, Ralph, if you work on the spiritual, the mental and the physical are straightened out. That's what it is that we really do, and what you guys have really brought to me
since I've been around this program, man. Sometimes if you're new to the fellowship, you'll hear a lot of people, and it'll sound mysterious. It'll sound out of reach. Folk will refer to it as the program. Some people will say the process. Some people will say the work. Some people will say, you know, what the hell is that where I live? Bill wrote in the book, and I love it. I am one of the people that talks a lot about the book, you know. And in the book Bill wrote, it's a manner of living. And dropped another line on it that really works. The manner of living that really works. I have a guy that I sponsor, and he comes up to me and says, I've been too busy to work the steps. But when, you've been too busy to work the steps, what else do you have? What the hell does that mean? You know, it's not something I do in my spare time off to the side. It's my life. Me. It's my life. See, if you're looking for the speaker that's going to come up in here tonight and try to scare you in the recovery, you need to get another speaker. If you're looking for the speaker tonight that's going to tell you, oh, if you get back out there, it's still kicking it, and you need another speaker. See, because the way that I am, I share with you, and I like Mary Emma last night because our experiences are similar. I did a lot. I did a whole lot of things when I was out there. And sometime in the midst of what I was doing, folk would look at me and be like, damn, Ralph, ain't you scared the way you're doing it? You're going to overdose? I'd be like, overdose? I'm scared of the deadly underdose. You better poison them. You don't scare alcoholic of my variety. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about the message of the whole me is the message that's got to have depth and that's got to have weight. And the message that this alcoholic has to bring you tonight that's got the most depth and the most weight is that you're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had given up on life. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had not answered an 8 o'clock wake-up call in a long time and thought I'd never be employable again. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old did not even know what school his little girl was enrolled in, no longer knew where his family stayed. You're looking at a guy who graduated from a major university in this country, and my job at the end of my drinking was taking the trash out for a 21-year-old. I was living in the back of my mother's garage. I was eating lemons off a neighbor's lemon tree for breakfast, and I stumbled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the men and women in this fellowship, the men and women in this fellowship loved me and nursed me back to health. They gave me a way out upon which we can all agree. They said, let us love you till you can love yourself, and I found that puzzling. I said, you lying. I stink. If you turn your back on me, I'm liable to go up in your purse. How are you going to tell me you'll love me till I can love myself? Didn't believe it. That was before I knew what takes place in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was before I knew what takes place when the God in you reaches out to the God in me. That was before I knew that in Alcoholics Anonymous we specialize in loving unlovable people. And you gave me my life back. You gave me some steps. Step one, admitted that I'm powerless. And nowhere in that step does it talk about accepting powerlessness. A lot of times I get carried away with this whole acceptance thing. Admit it that I'm powerless. Nowhere in there does it say accepting powerlessness. In fact, a little bit later in the book it says lack of power. What? That's my problem. Step one is the problem. Step two, can the believer power greater than me could restore me to sanity? That's the solution. Steps 3 through 12, 10-step program action to get me into the solution. Step three, made a decision to turn my will, which is my thinking, and my life, which is my actions, over to the care of God as I understood him. And I said to my sponsor, how can I do that? How am I going to turn my life over to God as I understand him? I don't understand him. My sponsor looked at me and said, Ralph, it ain't but two things you need to know about God in order to get on this path. Number one, he is. Number two, he ain't you. That's more than enough to begin. And from that beginning, all sorts of remarkable things have begun to happen in my life. If you're sitting in this room right now and you think this program is just about not drinking and just about not using, you're shortchanging the program and you're shortchanging yourself. Now, mind you, I'm not knocking physical sobriety. Nothing wrong with it. If you just don't drink, you may stop getting those DUIs on the weekend. If you just don't drink, you might stop beating up on your kids and your old lady. If you just don't drink, you might make it home with a whole paycheck. If you just don't drink, you might make it to work on Monday morning. But what this program has to offer is a whole lot more than that. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that does for me what I can't do for myself. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that can do anything but fail. What this program is really about, as I look around the room, new friends might be like me, especially in this new age where we like seeing stuff. You want to see the program? You want to put a face on the program? You want to take the steps off the wall and put some flesh on it? You want to see the program? Take a look around the room right now. What this program is really about is about people like us. Drunks and convicts and con artists and boosters and hustlers and prostitutes and tricks, child abusers, wife abusers, failures as parents, failures as kids, failures as employees, broken down pieces of men and women who don't have dreams and goals and hopes anymore. This program takes people like us, and I stick one hand in your hand, another hand in God's hand. We pick up our beds, we walk out of these rooms as mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, sons, daughters, employees, employers, role models in our community. This program is about growth. This program is about change. If it's to be any changes made in my life, it begins and it ends with me. I'm a person who gets the opportunity to work with a lot of men and women. I'm not one that's got a lot of those rules and a lot of don'ts. And don't go around these kind of people. Don't get in these kind of relationships. Don't do this. Don't do that. Do go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, with somebody who has working knowledge and experience with that book. Do apply the steps to your life to the best of your ability, right where you are, right now. Do work with another alcoholic. Do get in touch with a guy of your understanding. And then do whatever the hell you want to do. This program is about living. It ain't about losing. There was a hell of a sponsorship workshop that went on today, you know, and I really want to thank the people that were in that workshop, you know, and I got so much out of that. And one of the things that gets real clear to me, see, because I'm one of these people, you know, I talk a lot about the program. You know, somebody out there sitting out there right now and getting the wrong. See, I remember sitting out there right now, and it's two kinds of people to sit, you know, especially new. One person is sitting out there thinking, I can't wait to be the one standing up in front of them. I'm going to really give it up. Yeah, he think he's doing something up there, but he really needs to wait, you know, wait on me. When I get up there, you know, okay, that's cool. And it's another person that's on the opposite end of that spectrum. Not just at this kind of event, but at meetings too. Somebody's thinking, this guy must be working a hell of a program. Listen to the way he's sharing. And somebody else is thinking to themselves, I'll never be able to get in front of the group and share. Can I have this thing? The ability to share about the program of recovery ain't got a whole lot to do with the ability to live the program of recovery. It's a living program, and it's within the grasp. It's within the grasp, and it's within the reach of anybody sitting in these rooms. Don't get this twisted. What I'm doing tonight is a piece of recovery. I'm sharing with another alcoholic and the rest of this. But I'm standing at a podium. This ain't recovery, you know. This is a part of recovery. Talking about recovery, trust me, it's a whole lot different than living recovery. You know, and I have a friend back home that says, I'd rather see a sermon than hear a sermon any day. And that's what I've been struck by, the examples that have been set for me since I've come in this fellowship. I came in here at 33 years old, a scared little boy pretending to be a man. I had no clue about how to be a father. I had no clue about how to be a husband. I had no clue about consistently showing up at work. I had no clue about managing. And look at my life today, and sometimes you'll still think, what's different, you know, but check this out. The men and women in this fellowship, man, I came in here, and if you knew, and you come from walking the streets that I walked in the middle of a Friday or Saturday night, if you come from that place of no hope that I come from, If you come from walking the streets with nowhere to go, if you come from not being welcomed by your family, if you come from that place that somebody in here knows about being that next year parent, next year on Christmas and on birthdays, you doing what you do somewhere away from the rest of them, and you look at your clock, or if you, in my case, you look at the sun and kind of measure time, and you think to yourself, they're probably opening presents right now. Next year, I'm going to get that girl something. And as a result of coming in here and being a participating member of Alcoholics Anonymous, for the last 17 Christmases and the last 17 birthdays and the last 16 and a half every days in between, I have been a this year daddy. And I owe that to Alcoholics Anonymous, man. You know, in these 16 and a half years, every day ain't been, you know what? The thing that you guys have given me most, walking a spiritual path. See, because I'm a person that talks a lot about the steps. I'm a person that talks a lot about the process. I'm a person that talks a lot about the book. And I'm a person that'll stand in front of you and flatly say to you, book won't keep me sober, steps won't keep me sober, sponsor won't keep me sober, and meetings don't keep me sober. Book, sponsors, steps, meetings do put me in touch with a power that gives me the power to say no thank you. I am not drinking today. And the reason that is so important for me is because it is real easy and it's real seductive and it's real enticing to learn the information and to learn the steps so I can give it to somebody else, so that I can be God, as opposed to experiencing the process and experiencing the steps so I can share the experience with someone else to introduce them and me to God. Big difference. And as I do this thing, man, it is very seductive. Ralph, I like what you're sharing. Oh, John, somebody in here does a lot of sponsoring. And folk will give me the delusion that I got some answers. Well, hell, if my life is unmanageable by me, how the hell is your life supposed to be manageable by me? I'm real clear on sponsorship. My job is to introduce you to my manager, because I'm under new management. And I'm glad about it, because I didn't do so well managing my own affairs. And some days I still don't now. And thank God for the process of recovery. Thank God for a sponsor that says to me, Ralph, no matter what, God's grace is always sufficient to meet the need. Always sufficient to meet the need. No matter what. Because I go through some dark spots. I go through some moments in life in recovery. I go through some things, man. And check this out. If you come from that place of no hope and that place of uselessness and worthlessness and purposelessness, God has got something for you too. And the way that he fits me to be a service to his kids, see, this is the thing I like. I don't like it when it's happening, but this is what I like. Everybody in here qualifies. Everybody in here qualifies, because guess what the qualifications are? God works with me through my adversities. He works with me through my adversities. Because sometimes I got to be the message that I carry. And every year I get on my knees and say, God, I offer myself to you to build with me and do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I can better do thy will. Take away my difficulties for a reason. So victory over them may bear witness to somebody, to those I would help, but thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. If I claim God can handle anything, sometime I got to have something for him to handle. Somebody in here just got something for him to handle. And when I get on the other side of that, he can make use of me. Because I get to stand in front of you and say, guess what? I don't care if the IRS take most of your money. You ain't got a drink. How do I know that? Happened to me. Guarantee in this room right now, somebody can say, if your kids die, you ain't got a drink. How they know that? Happened to them. Somebody can stand up in front of us right now and say, if your mama dies, you ain't got a drink. How we know that? Had been there, done that. somebody in here. He uses me through my adversities. So no matter what it is that I'm going through, I have to understand that most of the time, the only reason why problems seem like they overwhelm me, man, is because I don't live in where I am right now. I live in the future. I have to ask myself, somebody's in a dark place right now. Somebody's in a situation where it just don't seem like it's no end. Somebody's in a situation where she better act right or he better act right, or if this money ain't there next week, and my sponsor says, is it all right right now? Right now. Not next week. Not when I go home. While this long-winded brother is up here, right? Is it all right? Right now. And every right now, it kept being all right. And I would get to the other side of a situation, and I'd be armed with what it is that we come to the table armed with that makes us invaluable. Experience. We the only people who can do what we can do. We the only people who can do what we can do. Who wouldn't want to be part of a fellowship like this? I used to say to myself when I was a kid, I want to be somebody important, and I want to do something significant. I want to leave my mark on the world. My grandmother used to say, God writes straight with crooked lines, and I didn't know what she meant till I made it to these rooms. Because every time I go to a meeting, every time I go to a meeting, I get to participate in some little boy or some little girl who I don't even know. Getting ready to have a mama come back in the house. Every time I go to a meeting, I get to participate in some wife or some family getting ready to have a husband or a father come back to the house. Every time I go to a meeting, I get to participate in some job or some employer who I could care less about getting ready to have a hell of an employee enter into the workplace. Every time I go to a meeting, and we uniquely qualify for that, man, who wouldn't want to be part of a fellowship like this? 10 years ago in September, another lady asked me to share a life with her. And she tried not to sit up there because she gets more nervous than me. So, Lee, I saw you slip in here, you know. I got all the way down the aisle this time. I got the I do out. We even have pictures to prove it. Somebody found me worthy. Got an 8-year-old daughter at home. Never seen her daddy load him one day at a time. She never will. That's the miracle. That's the miracle. You hear people all the time talk about they have a sponsor that they can absolutely rely on. You hear people all the time, like I talk about my mom. She's a rock and she's an anchor. And we have people in our lives, and it's amazing to me, because I'm just me. I know how fallible I am. I know I'm that guy. But to that 8-year-old little girl, God has done something with me. And in her eyes, I'm a rock. What kind of power is that? That 20-year-old daughter, she's 20. She was the 2-year-old daughter whose piggy bank I was going in. She'll be a junior at UCLA next year. She's living with us for the summer. She's getting her first apartment this summer. And from both my little girls, I get to look. Like, this is my daddy, and this is my hero. And I owe that to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I like the most about that power you introduced me to that gave me the power to do that one at a time, he ain't tired and he don't discriminate. He's still in the business of putting daddies back in the house. He's still in the business of mothers back with the kids. He's still in the business of putting families back together. He's still in the business of picking up drunks. And I'm still grateful. Whenever anybody anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous to be there. And for that, I'm responsible, and I take that responsibility seriously. I'm not one of the ones that will ever say, I don't know why I'm sober. I know exactly why I'm sober. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, that's my gift to God. My name is Ralph White. I am an alcoholic.